As a paranoid loony, I'm trying to maintain my objectivity in connection with this whole presentation, and maybe Burton Pines will help me out in connection with that. Burton's our next speaker. He's a research director of the Heritage Foundation, involved in all sorts of activities. Previously, associate editor of Time Magazine, has had a great deal of experience, and I think most of you know him anyway, so I'm not going to waste a lot of good talking time in any further introduction. Burton, if you will, please.
Sir.
Thank you very much, John. When Mel first called me several months ago and asked me to speak to this group, he asked me to address the proposition of whether differences between the varieties of conservatives are narrowing. And then, in Bradford tradition, he suggested that I argue that indeed they are narrowing. Well, not only am I susceptible to pressure from L. Bradford, but also it's a proposition which I welcome. It's the kind of offer I found difficult to refuse, because I indeed do believe that the various strands of conservatism increasingly have more in common and less separating them than ever before. Now, to be sure, as we have just heard, we still have our honorable and distinguished differences. We here know what those differences are, and we have spent more hours and more days debating them than we can count. We relish every minute of the debate. We celebrate these differences. They are, after all, extremely important, centering fundamentally on man's place in the world and the world's place in the cosmos. And these differences continue among young conservatives. I see this every fortnight at the Heritage Foundation's third generation lecture series, gatherings of 100 or so conservatives in their 20s and very, very early 30s, too early 30s. These are lively, intent, passionate debates among young conservatives about their differences. The debates among us have enriched us individually and certainly have enriched our nation. In this room, perhaps more than any place else, we have known the joys of the tensions between the libertarians' passion for freedom and the classical conservatives' deep concern for order. The libertarian has something to teach us about individual freedom and the dangers of authority of any kind. The neoconservative teaches us about the nature of our enemy. The neoconservative reminds us about the grand and proud tradition of compassion within conservative ranks. And I think ability to analyze the welfare state and talk about the welfare state merely reflects a very grand tradition among conservatives of compassion. I hope we do not recognize, we do not say that we have given up to the left a monopoly of compassion. If anything, the left has abandoned the individual to the cold of nature, whilst the conservative, who recognizes that those who are better endowed than others have a responsibility to fellow man. And the neoconservatives remind us of that tradition. The neoconservative is, by giving two cheers for capitalism, let's be frank about it, one cheer more than we hear from some classical conservatives. The traditional conservative reminds us of Edmund Burke's lessons of the virtue of order and the cautious approach to history, and perhaps most important, as you well know, of our compact with preceding and subsequent generations. But while differences remain, I believe that these differences today make less a difference than ever before. American conservatives seem, by and large, more harmonious than ever before. The reason for this is obvious. The experience which we have shared as we've been transformed from a movement or movements in opposition to one which governs. It is this which also has transformed our focus. Instead of being almost obsessed, as we were in opposition, with what divides us, we've had to focus more on what we have in common. In this, we have discovered much about us that we share, perhaps more than many of us suspected. Our narrowing of differences even began before we were governed. It began in the 1970s, a decade so terrible that it mobilized or frightened or awakened all kinds of conservatives to a common danger and gave us at least a common determination to battle a common enemy and a determination to save this republic. It gave us all, in short, a determination to repeal the 1970s. That was a dreadful decade. The United States was on the retreat on almost every front. We surrendered to high taxes, to bracket creep, to inflation, gas lines, government meddling evermore in our lives. We surrendered to street crime and the coddling of criminals, to falling educational standards, the steady erosion of traditional values, and to traditional morality. We surrendered to the ridicule of religion and of the religious, and to functional illiteracy. And we surrendered to the notion that America's children no longer are entitled to believe that they will lead lives better than their parents. We retreated in Vietnam, Angola, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, and in the face of OPEC. We surrendered the Panama Canal, closed their eyes to Soviet treaty violations, and at the United Nations apologized obsessively for being America and daring to have national interests. We squirmed helplessly as Iranian fanatics humiliated us and held us hostage for 444 days. And we saw one president after another, Nixon and Ford and Carter, defeated by the problems they faced and turned haggard by the burdens of presidency. America in the 1970s seemed to have grown used to soaring inflation and interest rates, shrinking economic opportunities, abuse and humiliation overseas, and leaders who told us that less is more, small is beautiful, and yesterday was better than tomorrow ever will be. Well, it was a dreadful, dreadful decade in what happened and what it symbolized. And we became convinced, each in our own way, that what we had to do was oppose that decade and repeal it. This conviction swelled our ranks. It swelled our ranks. It spawned the new right, the Christian right, the legions of politically active fundamentalists, the neoconservatives, the ethnic conservatives, the blue-collar right, the politicized homemakers, and others still emerging, such as Hispanic and Black conservatives. This conviction also transformed much of the traditionally cerebral right into activists. What gradually happened to each of us in this process is that we realized, perhaps more than we ever had before, that what we were doing was fighting the battle to save the West. In that battle against the 1970s, it became clear to us and to our enemies that we are the West, that we are the affirmation of 3,000 years of tradition, of wrestling with the most basic and profound of issues, with definitions of right and wrong, of human limitations, of good and evil. Unlike the philosophies of the left, which are a conscious effort to reject and destroy Western tradition, we learned in the 1970s, many of us, that the varieties of conservatives affirmed this tradition. We knew what we wanted to conserve. The left merely knew what it needs to destroy. In the 1970s, a searing experience, we found that we pretty much could agree on who were the West's enemies. While each of us had our own hierarchy of who was the worst and which was the worst enemy, and our hierarchies differed then and differ now, we by and large concluded that among the varieties of enemies the West faced and against which we must battle were the Soviet Union, big government, big taxers, radical feminists, secular humanists, moral and value relativists, the State Department, the elite media, the new class, the United Nations, the Blame America First establishment, and others. Well, if our differences began narrowing in the 1970s as we fought the common enemy, we became more conscious of what we share as we began to govern in the 1980s. We had no choice but to do so. In opposition, understandably, we had the luxury of being able to take pure, uncompromising positions. But given the chance to make public policy, to serve in government, to provide the analyses and advice to which officials look for guidance, in short, to pursue that broad array of activities of those who govern, we have been forced to bend and compromise where we had not thought possible before. We have realized, as we did not have to do while we were in opposition, we have realized that the best really is the enemy of the good, that the important really often must be sacrificed to the urgent, and that it is essential, above all essential, to forge alliances. Now, I'm not implying that fundamental principles have been abandoned. I don't want to be misunderstood. I simply am stating that we seem to be learning that a fundamental principle need not be the litmus test of every single action. Thus, we've learned to build coalitions on the right. We find that neocons can work with libertarians on economic issues, even if tensions exist regarding defense policy. We find that traditional conservatives can work with the Christian right on education and cultural issues, even if tensions remain on the legitimate role of government or in such matters as free trade. More important, we have found that we have begun educating each other. The Christian right, for example, rarely, very rarely, had thought about foreign policy. By working with other conservatives, however, the Christian right first came to appreciate why the neocons and traditionalists are so concerned about the Soviet threat. And then, as the Christian right learned more about the Soviet threat, we began to find that members of the Christian right began supporting a get-tough-with-Moscow foreign policy. On issues of individual liberty, libertarians are growing to understand, though certainly not to support, but at least growing to understand why the Christian right so ferociously battles abortion and pornography. And the Christian right, in turn, is coming to appreciate why the libertarian so passionately worries about government sanctions against such individual transactions as purchasing publications which may be regarded as pornographic or obtaining an abortion. The result of this is not enthusiastic support for each other's position. It may not even be support of any kind for each other's position. More typical is friendly tolerance, a word that may offend some indeed, but what has happened, I see, is a kind of friendly tolerance. And this has meant a significant waning of the testy, even vitriolic confrontation within conservative ranks. Not everywhere, to be sure, but most everywhere. Disappearing is a snide reference, at least in public. And since this is a private meeting, I think my generalization still holds. Disappearing is the snide reference, at least in public, by one kind of conservative of another. Gone almost entirely, at least in public, is ridicule and animosity. This is extremely significant because it has spawned a kind of mutual respect which allows much closer and more effective cooperation on those issues on which various conservatives do agree. And it keeps eroding the areas of disagreement. Now, something else has been eroding as well, something which may have contributed to significantly and still to some extent, the friction between various conservatives. And though it may be improper to bring this up in polite society, I don't think it can be ignored. I'm talking about class differences. It is understandable that the cosmopolitan or academic or intellectual conservative may have balked at embracing and welcoming into conservative ranks the low church, pulpit-thumping, Bible-waving preacher, or the activists who mobilize tens of thousands of homemakers against equal rights amendment, or those who make life miserable for abortion advocates. There's a world of difference in tone and education and perhaps upbringing and manners between those genteel conservatives who long have waged the battle of ideas and those street-smart conservatives who've recruited legions of activists for the battle. There's a world of difference between those who chose to spend their lives in the cozy, though embattled, though very embattled, in the cozy, though embattled confines of the campus, and those who relish life in the trenches, between those exhilarated by turning a phrase or impaling an adversary on a non sequitur, and those who may regard parsing a sentence as an unnatural act. And I think that we can admit it. Some of us enjoyed being a tiny band of intellectual warriors, bereft of political power, but comforted by the thought that we were of the elect. There may be some resentment of those who are transforming us from an elite into a majoritarian movement. After all, 40 million Frenchmen can't possibly be right. In opposition, these very real differences in class, and I think lifestyle is not quite the right word. Class, I think, is. These differences in class kept some conservatives at arm's length from others, understandably, predictably. The requirements of governing, however, have eroded these barriers considerably. Class frictions within conservative ranks today are much less than they were as recently as 1980. And of course, differences have been narrowed because of the Reagan presidency. I'm not only talking about Reagan's policies and actions and how our support for many, but certainly not all of them, forced us to focus on what we have in common. I'm reminded of Elliot Abrams' presentation last night of why it's good for the morale of Nicaraguans for us to recognize their country and the Sandinista regime. I'm not sure that's a policy on which we would support the Reagan administration. And recognize there are many policies we don't support. And I'm talking less about policies. I'm talking more about Reagan's style and Reagan's rhetoric, which expresses so much of what we believe. As conservatives, we long have recognized the importance of rhetoric. And Ronald Reagan's is conservative rhetoric, in many ways, at its best. He says what we want said. And hearing it, I will argue, hearing it has brought us together. His use of the Oval Office as a bully pulpit reflects the conservative ideal of the nation's leader as teacher. Reagan mounts the bully pulpit to inspire and educate. His rhetoric gives us confidence in our system of government. It nurtures America's intrinsic optimism and patriotism. It contrasts extraordinarily with the whining of Nixon, the pessimism of Kissinger, and the self-flagellation of a Jimmy Carter. Who here fails? Well, let me rephrase that. Very few here, in fact, may fail to be thrilled by the Reagan rhetoric. Many few here may fail to feel a conservative kinship to other conservatives when we hear Reagan talk about America as the last best hope of man on earth, as a Zion in the wilderness, as a city on the hill. And let me take a moment to recall some of the other things that Reagan says, which I think, in fact, helps blur some of the differences between conservatives and make it easier for us to work together. In the second inaugural, Reagan asked, if not us, who? And if not now, when? He has told us that there are no limits to growth in human progress. Our nation is poised for greatness. He has dared brand the Soviet Union an evil empire. And in his recent State of the Union speech, he spoke bluntly of the threat from Soviet forces, from the Soviet drive for domination, from the increase in espionage and state terrorism. Need we remind ourselves of what Cyrus Vance said, in contrast Reagan's statement with Cyrus Vance telling us that Carter and Brezhnev, quote, share similar dreams and aspirations on all important issues, end quote. And they probably did. And in his first inaugural, Reagan concluded with a kind of statement which has echoed through America through its entire history, except in the 1970s. A statement with which every kind of conservative, could make with confidence. He said, and after all, why shouldn't we believe that? We are Americans. To be sure, conservatives continue to have differences. We must neither sacrifice our differences nor abandon them. But what we have learned to do is to recognize and focus on more of what we share than on what we divide us. In the recent issue of Policy Review, George Nash tells us that this is the moment of conservative opportunity. I'd like to add that this is the moment of conservative challenge. If we are to meet this challenge and exploit this opportunity, we should work together more. We have to work together harder on what we share. If we are serious about governing, we must move forcefully, let me suggest, on three specific areas in which I believe we have broad agreement. First, we must fight to reduce the role of government in American lives. This means in a very policy-specific way, using our various talents to support those policies which cut the government, such as lower taxes, a balanced budget, privatization of services. Second, we must challenge the Soviet Union. This means working together for a policy of rollback based on support for anti-communist national liberation movements in Angola, Nicaragua, Afghanistan, Mozambique, and elsewhere. It means backing measures which hurt the Soviet Union, such as denying them Western credits. It means backing measures which makes maintaining the Soviet Union more costly. It means backing Reagan's strategic defense program, which will deprive the Kremlin of its current ability to brandish nuclear weapons to intimidate or blackmail us. And third, and this I think is most important, we must identify and defeat our enemies here in the United States. We must do a better job of that. We must name, as Mitch Dechter has advised us, we must name more names. We must identify and defeat our enemies in this country. At the same time, we must translate our conservative vision and promise, our conservative heritage, into a form comprehensible and appealing to whole new groups. You know, in a way, we must become better evangelists. Ours is the good news gospel, and we can be more successful than we have been in explaining to Jews, blacks, and Hispanics why conservative principles and programs offer them a better economic, social, and political future. With our help, Ronald Reagan has launched a conservative revolution, But only we can make this revolution triumph. And only we can make this revolution survive beyond the Reagan presidency. And we can do this only if we prevent our differences from getting in the way of the very much we have in common. If we are to govern, then we must want to govern. And we then must be ready to open our ranks to those whom we need to govern. As an elite, we may be able to lead. But to govern, we must become a majority. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Burton. We have a saying in Indiana that it's better to govern than be governed. And I think Burton reconvinced me of that this morning.